KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering an online hybrid doctorate of education in organizational leadership on campus in West LA, with attendance only twice per term. GSEP.pepperdine.edu.
From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning. I'm Larry Mantle. Right now, a news conference taking place in New York City. A series of suspicious packages delivered to CNN's New York City headquarters at Time Warner Center, also the Clintons' home in Chappaqua, New York. Here's James O'Neill, NYPD commissioner, speaking to reporters live. Reporter asking a question a little bit difficult to hear. Hopefully we'll pick this up.
I'm just going to say something broad, because at a time where there's a lot of hatred and division, it does not make sense to exacerbate it. Let's just say this to all public officials of all partisan affiliations. Don't encourage violence. Don't encourage hatred. Don't encourage attacks on media. You could disagree, but you have to show respect for people and air your disagreements peacefully. So, unfortunately, this atmosphere of hatred is contributing to the choices people are making to turn to violence. There's no question about it. And the way to stop that is to turn back the other way, to bring down the temperature, to end any messages about the use of violence against people we disagree with. And that has to start at the top.
And again, look, this is a political year.
Governor Andrew Cuomo.
We are weeks from an election, and that's obviously in the air, and that's an obvious fact. But we've been through many political seasons, and we have political differences, and that's actually good for democracy. What is not good is overheated rhetoric, extremism that pushes people to violence. And at the end of the day, we may have political differences, but this is one country. We're all Americans, e pluribus unum, out of many one, and keeping the debate and the dialogue civil is very, very important. And for elected leaders who in many ways set the tone, it is especially important.
Hold on. Right there.
Can you describe what the device looks like that was found?
John?
Sure. Brian Parman from FBI JTTF. So far, the devices
NYPD.
Have been what appear to be pipe bombs.
If I could, I'd like to make a statement. I know that a lot of the public right now is scared and concerned, and there's a lot of confusion surrounding this. I want to assure you that the reason we are here, because the totality of the federal, state, and local authorities will investigate this thoroughly and follow every lead. And we will turn over every rock, we will turn every corner, and we will talk to everybody that we have to in order to mitigate this threat. The mission of the New York Joint Terrorism Task Force is to protect the American people and uphold the Constitution. The utilization of violence in order to further one's own political agenda is unacceptable to us, and we will not rest until we find this, stop these hazardous devices from being mailed, and bring the individual or individuals to justice. We have no better partners in the NYPD, the New York State Police, and the entirety of the Joint Terrorism Task Force. We will be on this until the day that we find this individual and bring him to justice. I'd like to thank NYPD and our partners on the task force, as well as the United States Secret Service, as well as the U.S. Capitol Police, as well as the Westchester County authorities for the cooperation and collaboration that we have thus far. And with that, I'll turn it back over for questions, sir.
That's the FBI special agent brought in for the investigation.
Hold on a second.
As you've heard, there is a number of devices, and there's a pattern, apparently, to the number of devices. We wouldn't be at all surprised if more devices show up. A device has been sent to my office in Manhattan, which we were just informed about, and that device is also being handled. So again, this is a situation. A number of devices have been sent. They're being handled. We wouldn't be surprised if additional devices are sent. And the device that is been sent to my office has been identified and is being handled as we speak.
It's Governor Andrew Cuomo just saying he just got word an apparently suspicious device, perhaps explosive, sent to his New York City office.
Terrorism related, right? Terrorism is an attempt to strike terror, an attempt to strike fear. Obviously, these devices are an attempt to strike fear, hence terrorism. Are they domestic? Are they international? These are all questions that would have to be handled by the investigation. But yes, it was a terrorist attempt. It was a terrorist attack. And as you said, what's the intent? To strike fear. And when they strike fear, they win. That's when they are effective. Who controls that? We control that. We control that. This is not the first time we have been through this. We have been through this many, many times. Literally, as I mentioned before, it goes back 25 years to the first World Trade Center bombing. This is New York. It is part of who we are and part of our profile. So we refuse to be intimidated. We refuse to allow them to make us afraid of going through our daily lives. We have the best law enforcement agencies. We're all working together. We're all here. And we're going to go about our daily lives, enjoying this beautiful city and state. And we're not going to let them win, period. Kate, you had a question?
This is Governor Andrew Cuomo of New York, live news conference in New York City after a series of explosive devices were delivered, including to CNN's Time Warner Center newsroom and studios.
I just want to remind everybody here and all New Yorkers, any tips, any leads,
please, Commissioner James O'Neill.
Call 911 or 1-888-NYC-SAFE. Thank you very much, everybody. Thank you. Thank you.
You've been listening to a live news conference in New York City. Police Commissioner James O'Neill, the last person to speak. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio also identified that the device that was delivered to CNN's mailroom at Time Warner Center appeared to be an active explosive device, and that there was an envelope with white powder was also included in that. Also, authorities there, including John Miller of the NYPD, who's the counterterrorism expert there, Governor Andrew Cuomo, all of them talking about the need to ratchet down the overheated rhetoric that's part of our political world. All of the figures who received these suspicious packages that were believed to have had explosives in them were figures on the left. Yesterday was billionaire George Soros at his home, where apparently the package was opened just inside the gates of his estate. No explosions have occurred, but Soros is a financier, a supporter of causes and candidates on the left. The Clintons' home in Chappaqua, New York, there was a device that was sent there. It didn't arrive because all their mail is done at a separate secure facility. It never got to the Clintons' home, but it was addressed to them. There also, we had earlier reports today of a package sent to the Obamas. Again, didn't get to their residence. And we have a report that Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the congresswoman from Florida, who's the former head of the Democratic National Committee, that the Broward Sheriff's Office is using a bomb squad robot there investigating a suspicious package at her office, which is in Sunrise near Fort Lauderdale, Florida. White House spokeswoman Sarah Huckabee Sanders tweeted that President Trump and the administration are monitoring the situation closely. She called these cowardly acts unacceptable and that they won't be tolerated. President Trump is expected to speak soon about these series of devices that were sent. We'll also hear just the beginning of the news conference. This was Police Commissioner James O'Neill who started things off. Then it was Governor Andrew Cuomo who followed up.
Our intel, emergency services, and Patrol Bar Manhattan South responded immediately, secured the area, and began a search of the building. Responding officers identified a device that appeared to be a live explosive device. NYPD bomb squad responded, secured the device, and removed it for investigation. Additionally, there was an envelope containing white powder that was discovered as part of that original packaging, and we're in the middle of investigating that right now. The area has been swept with dogs and equipment and found no additional threats besides the white powder. And working with our law enforcement partners, we responded swiftly to secure the scene.
I think that might have been Mayor de Blasio, actually. Next, we hear Governor Andrew Cuomo.
We, at this time, do not have other credible and specific threats against locations in New York City. I want to let all New Yorkers know you can go about your daily routine knowing the NYPD and all these other agencies are here to protect you. It's important to note that this is an ongoing investigation. As we have more information, we will provide it. But I emphasize there is no specific threat against any other location in this city at this time. That said, the NYPD and all of our partners have reinforced our very clear, visible presence at key media locations around New York City and other important locations. So you will see a lot more police presence. That should be reassuring to all New Yorkers.
Now, the governor made that statement just a few minutes before he received word that his office in New York City had received a suspicious device. So he said, as you just heard the clip, he hadn't heard of anything more. And then a few minutes later had to update that. And finally, is this third clip? Is this Governor Cuomo as well? OK, Governor Cuomo talking about the importance of how to respond to the series of packages.
Finally, I want to say this is a very painful time in our nation. It's a time when people are feeling a lot of hatred in the air. And incidents like this exacerbate that pain and exacerbate that fear. We cannot let the acts of a very few change who we are. It's really important at a moment like this to remember the vast majority of Americans, the vast majority of New Yorkers are good people trying to live in peace with each other. There are a few people, and we don't know who they are today, but there are a few people trying to tear us apart through acts of violence. It is imperative that we ensure they fail. It is imperative that we act as the good and decent people that we are. This is a moment in history that's painful, but it will pass. This too shall pass.
That from the news conference that concluded just a few minutes ago in New York City after an explosive device was found at the Time Warner Center, where CNN has its studios and newsroom. It apparently was received by the mailroom inside CNN, also a white powder in an envelope that was contained in that package. Authorities believing it's also linked to an explosive device that was addressed to the Clintons at their home in Chappaqua, New York, and yesterday that was received at the estate outside New York City, where the billionaire George Soros, who supports left-wing causes and candidates, where he resides. With us, Cleve Wootson, reporter for The Washington Post. Cleve, thank you for joining us. Given the array of packages that have been received, I would guess that the office buildings for the House and for the Senate are also getting extra security and that they're keeping a lookout. Do you have any word on what's going on preventively there?
I'm not clear. I do know that there is kind of that the Secret Services said that there's kind of an alert all over. I would assume that anybody who's in any position of prominence or who think they might be a victim or a potential target would be beefing up their security right now.
All right. And any additional details you can share with us about how these investigations are proceeding?
You know, I'm unsure. What I think is happening is that there's this search or law enforcement is trying to ensure that there aren't more packages out there, you know, to figure out if you know, there are several, half a dozen so far that have gone out. And now they're trying to see, okay, are these things in other places? And then they can begin to connect the dots and compare evidence and all of that stuff. But, you know, no one knows, I guess, at this point, or no one is saying, at least at this point, whether or not they know the total number of packages that are out there.
Yeah, as we were just hearing in the news conference, Governor Cuomo in New York talking about no word of it. And then he found out his own office in New York had received something. And again, you know, we want to caution that everybody is now hypervigilant. And so anything that could possibly be perceived as threatening is going to be taken that way. It doesn't mean that all these reports are confirmed. For example, in Southern California, the office of the San Diego Union-Tribune was evacuated because of boxes that they thought looked suspicious. The Los Angeles Times, which owns the UT, sharing this information about the evacuation. So we want to caution that every time there's an evacuation doesn't mean that there's actually an explosive device. But clearly there are several at this point. And the governor of New York saying we wouldn't be at all surprised if more devices turn up. Cleve, I want to thank you for being with us. Appreciate your sharing with us the very latest on it. We have a listener who worked up on Capitol Hill who shared with us that all the mail to the Senate and the House goes to a separate location, and that happened actually after the anthrax mailings that occurred back in 2001, that they started with a security that clears everything. So similar to the Clintons' mail, it doesn't, you send something to the Clintons' house, it doesn't go to their house. It goes to a facility well away where everything is screened, and that's become standard practice with many of these high-profile individuals. Also with us is William Braniff, director of the National Consortium for the Study of Terrorism and Responses to Terrorism, known at START at the University of Maryland. He previously served as Director of Practitioner Education. He was an instructor at West Point's Combating Terrorism Center. Thank you, sir, for being with us. We appreciate it.
Well, thank you for having me.
Give us a sense of how investigators, the FBI, of course, at this point, is attempting to determine the source of the mailings.
Sure. So, I mean, as we speak, the improvised explosive devices that have been found are on their way or have already arrived at an FBI facility where very senior and experienced bomb technicians from the FBI will break down those IEDs and document what they find for both investigative and for evidentiary purposes. Similarly, the packaging that the bombs were either shipped in or delivered in by hand will be similarly examined for both evidence and investigative leads. And the investigation will go very quickly from there.
The fact that these packages with the explosive devices have been received within about a 24-hour period, would that lead you to believe that we're not into any potential copycat phase yet?
I think that's a fair assessment. It takes time to both obtain the precursor chemicals required to make improvised explosive devices, whether those are more mundane sources of explosives or more rare and exotic sources of explosives. But it still takes some time and effort unless you happen to have these things on hand. But the partisan nature of the targets in this instance suggest that this was one plan or plot conducted either by an individual or a group. And of course, we don't know. I don't have any insight into that, nor the real motivation of the attacker or the plotter, despite what the targets might suggest to us. And I would just point people to an example in 2010, where an individual sent what looked to be an explosive device to President Obama. To frame her husband, not because of any ideological motivation. And so we really have to let this play out to understand the true motive of the potential or the perpetrators.
Now, fortunately, none of these devices has exploded. Typically, these kinds of devices, are they made to detonate upon the opening of the package, or how do these IEDs usually work?
It can be any number of ways. There can be a timer associated with the bomb so that once it is set, the bomb will go off when that timer tells it to go off. There can be remote detonation involving something like a cell phone or some sort of digital transmission so that the person conducting the attack can control the exact moment of the attack or the detonation. They could also be packages meant to look like explosives that have many of the components of explosives that have white powder to create the presence or the appearance of, say, anthrax, but that are inert and were really only intended to have that psychological shock value as opposed to the actual explosive damage. And so, again, we have to see what the nature of these explosives are. This is exactly what the bomb technicians will be determining. They'll be looking for signatures that would tie these bombs together. They'd be looking for key features that they can communicate through law enforcement channels so that the law enforcement community writ large across the country can successfully identify another one, if there's another one out there, more readily. And they're going to be looking for any evidence of future attacks to maintain, public safety. After that, after public safety is assured, they'll start to really turn towards motive and understand the why in this instance.
How difficult is it to track the packages back to the sender if you don't have fingerprints necessarily? How difficult is it to look at the root of the package?
Well, I'm not sure, to be frank. People can start the transit of that package from anywhere in the country if they were so inclined, right? They could drive 300 miles away from their home or where they built the explosive and put it in a mailbox that has really no correlation to where they live or work. That is not necessarily the norm when we look at patterns of procurement of weapons and fabrication of weapons in the United States. We don't typically see that great of a distance between where someone lives and works and where they plot, but it certainly has happened in the United States. It's certainly possible. And then depending on the way that package was sent, there's a different levels of tracking. And we all know that from when we've used the Postal Service or other shipping services. We can opt into greater level of information, and I'm sure in this instance the perpetrators would not have done that.
I want to thank you, sir. Really appreciate your talking with us about the investigation that federal authorities be carrying out. That's William Braniff of the University of Maryland's National Consortium for the Study of Terrorism and Responses to Terrorism. He directs the START Center at the University of Maryland. He's taught at West Point's Combating Terrorism Center and directed the Practitioner Education Program at West Point as well. We are covering the ongoing news of explosive devices that have been sent to a number of different individuals and locations, CNN's New York City newsroom and studios at Time Warner Center, which was earlier evacuated, addressed to the Clintons' home in Chappaqua, New York, to the Obamas at their home, the governor of New York's New York City office, as well as the attorney general and others. So we're bringing you the very latest on that. By the way, way, the San Diego Union Tribune, this is just an example of, I'm sure, many others that will have the boxes that caused alarm there that led to the evacuation of their office building were just boxes that someone had left that had some books and a football and shoes. So everything's fine there in San Diego. Folks are able to go back into the building at the San Diego Union Tribune. So that kind of high-level concern, we're going to be hearing from a number of other locations where there isn't any direct threat. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up, we're going to talk about a ballot measure which would establish year-round daylight saving time, provided the feds go in the same direction. Back in a minute. I just want to assure you that we will be bringing you the latest on the explosive devices that have been sent to a number of individuals, prominent Democrats, as well as to CNN. Any new information, we'll bring that to you right here on Air Talk. But as part of our continuing series focused on the ballot propositions, Proposition 7 will give Californians a chance to vote on whether they'd like the state legislature to consider establishing year-round daylight saving time. Now, currently, Arizona is on year-round standard time, just like Hawaii, but this would be year-round daylight saving time. So we wouldn't change our clocks come November and every year in March as well. With us to talk about the measure, what it would actually do, and what else would have to happen, even if it's passed, is proponent Cheyenne Roy, who's the president-elect of the L.A. County Medical Association and also a practicing cardiologist. Thank you so much, Dr. Roy, for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Larry, to talk about Proposition 7, though this seems somewhat trivial compared to the topic that you were talking about in the last segment.
Yeah, it's certainly a different level of seriousness, but we will be back to cover that. President Trump, by the way, is expected to speak soon, and we'll interrupt this to hear what the president has to say. But Dr. Roy, you co-authored the argument in favor of this. So just first mechanically, if voters approved this, then what additional steps would have to happen for permanent daylight saving time to be enacted?
So then, if voters do pass Proposition 7, the legislature would then be authorized to move California to petition the federal government to either operate year-round in Pacific Daylight Time or Pacific Standard Time. And so, if the legislature approves year-round Pacific Daylight Time, then Congress must act to allow for an exemption to the Uniform Act of 1966. But no federal action would be required if the legislature chooses Pacific Standard Time, as you mentioned, which is the case in Arizona.
Oh, okay. So this applies then both to the potential of permanent standard as well as permanent daylight times?
Yeah. So this would go into the hands of the legislature, and they would decide. They would develop consensus on which way the legislature would want to go.
Okay, I see. And then they'd petition the federal government, and Congress would have to approve that request.
Only if we elect to use Pacific Standard Time, no federal action would be required. But if we go to Pacific Daylight Time, year-round Pacific Daylight Time, then Congress would have to act.
Okay. And do you favor permanent daylight saving or permanent standard?
As a cardiologist, I got involved in this really on the significant, not because of the significance of one of the times or the other. I got involved in this because when you spring forward, there's been good data showing that there are negative health effects. So cardiovascular, for example, this has been studied. They studied a large cohort of patients in Sweden, and it showed that there was a significant increase in the 3 days after the spring forward in cardiovascular events. And this is likely due to the pathophysiological insult of the stress created by decreased sleep in that short period of time.
So you're against the shift. That's what you think the health hazard is.
I'm involved because I'm against the shift in general.
Okay. We're talking with Dr. Shion Roy, a president-elect L.A. County Medical Association. He also directs Harbor-UCLA's inpatient cardiac CT center, but they are not taking a position. That's just incidental. That's his day job, but his work on behalf of Proposition 7 is a personal cause of his that he has taken on. Also with us from the Energy Institute at UC Berkeley's Haas School of Business, the director of that program, Severin Bornstein. Severin, thank you for being with us again. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
What are the potential energy savings of going to year-round daylight saving?
Well, there have been a number of studies on this, and basically they find essentially no change. There's been one that finds a slight increase in energy use, one that finds essentially no change, one that finds a slight decrease, but all of these are very small, less than 1%. And there's a lot of uncertainty in all of those estimates. And the fact is that in the winter, we get less than 10 hours of light, of sunlight, and that doesn't change. We're up for much more than 10 hours. So if we shift the clocks, it doesn't change how much sunlight we get. It just changes when we get it. And so the studies that have looked at energy use have found that while going on longer daylight saving time does result in less energy use in the evening, it results in more energy use in the morning.
All right.
So it's just about offset.
Shion Roy, I'm curious about the safety issues here because, and I'm going to be kind of crude with the hours that I use just for the sake of conversation. But so theoretically, in the winter, if we were on permanent daylight saving, you'd have sunset, let's say, around 6 o'clock in Southern California instead of around 5 o'clock. That would mean if, you know, in the peak of winter, you'd have 10 hours of daylight, so it wouldn't get light till around 8 o'clock in the morning. Are you concerned about the potential of kids, going to school in the dark, people driving to work in the dark? A high percentage of people would be on the move before the sun comes up.
So there is some uncertainty there, obviously, depending on where the legislature would decide to put the clocks in terms of the a shift in periods of darkness. But there is clear evidence in terms of healthcare-related negative effects regarding the shift that takes place. There's increase in on-the-job injuries. There's increase in deadly vehicle accidents from the shift. So you're talking about driving in the dark, but we already have evidence that there's significant increase is in deadly vehicle accidents on the Mondays after the spring forward. Additionally, there's an increase in stroke risk in the 2 days following the spring forward. So while there is some uncertainty, if there is, depending on what happens, if this passes and the legislature sets a specific time, there is certainty that the effect of spring forward has negative health effects.
All right. Oh, Gia, Newport Beach, I stole your thunder. I'm sorry. She called in and wanted to make the same point about kids going to school in the winter morning in the dark. Gia, I'm sorry. I just saw that. Robert, in Harbor City in L.A., what do you think about the potential of going to year-round daylight saving time?
Well, I think we should actually go to year-round standard time. So that scientifically the sun at noon is directly above your time zone. And then, like in Europe, specifically Germany, I know for a fact, what they do is they don't have any daylight savings time change. What they do is have summer hours and winter hours. So we could simply, and since businesses have different hours for, their individual businesses, you just change the time to match what's the optimum time for energy savings.
That's an interesting idea. So you shift the work time instead of the clock. I think the challenge with Californians accepting permanent standard time is that in the summer months, it would be getting dark at say 7 o'clock at night instead of 8 o'clock at night. And I think, you know, many Californians look forward to the later sunset, so there's that additional time after work that people are able to enjoy. Severin Bornstein, your thoughts about Robert's proposal of changing work hours instead of the clock itself?
Well, actually, Robert's view highlights exactly what I think the problem would be if we went off the current system. And that is, people will adapt to the fact that it gets light at different times. Right now, we have sort of a society-wide agreement that we do that adaptation by everybody on the same day changing their clocks. What would happen instead is, for instance, schools would have winter hours and summer hours, or fall and spring hours, whereas the daycare you take your kid to would also shift, but at a different time and by a different amount.
Yeah.
And your work hours would shift by a different time and at a different point in the calendar. And instead of us all doing a coordinated shift to adapt to these shorter days in the winter, which are not going to change, of course, that's the tilt of the earth. Instead of all adapting in a coordinated way, we would adapt in an uncoordinated way. And for people taking their kids to school and their kids to childcare and going to work, I think that would be a massive headache.
All right.
The health effects, it is true that these studies have shown that right after the spring forward, we see heart attacks and other health effects that are negative. Some of them have shown that actually we see positive effects in the fall back. And the net effects, when you net those two out, I think are very uncertain.
All right. I need to conclude with you there. That's Severin Bornstein, director of UC Berkeley's Haas School of Business Energy Institute. Let me bring back Sean Roy, L.A. County Medical Association president-elect. A final word, sir, on and why you think voters should support Prop 7.
Well, so this puts it in the hands of the legislature. And just as, you know, Severin made some very valid points, I think part of this is a cultural issue, though. So I grew up in Arizona, and, you know, when I first moved out of Arizona to the East Coast, it was daylight savings time that was weird, and daylight savings time that caused a lifestyle change that was unorthodox to me. And so I think that as a group in California, you know, over the long term, people will adapt to whatever pattern is, whatever time is adapted. But the stress caused by that spring forward is what's most concerning to me.
Gentlemen, I want to thank you both very much. That's Dr. Sean Roy, who's L.A. County Medical Association president-elect and co-authored the official argument in the State Voter Information Guide in favor of Prop 7. In opposition, Severin Bornstein, the noted energy expert who joins us from time to time on Energy Matters on Air Talk. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up, a controversial measure in San Francisco that split the high-tech community and the big employers there. Back after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdies. Just want to reinforce what Hedy just said about our continuing coverage of these suspicious packages, some of which have been confirmed with explosive devices that have been sent to individuals largely along the East Coast. And we will bring you the very latest developments as we have them. Right now, we turn our attention to a very controversial measure on the San Francisco City County ballot. It's Prop C, and it's a tax on the gross receipt of businesses designed to collect, on average, 0.5% of businesses' gross receipts for the larger employers, $50 million annual revenue companies and up. The money would go to homeless services and housing in San Francisco. With us to talk about the details, San Francisco Chronicle reporter Kevin Fagan. Kevin, thank you for joining us. First, how divisive has this been within the business community?
It's been divisive in a high profile way. It's hard to tell exactly how many businesses are against it. A lot of people lined up for it. The Chamber of Commerce is leading the way against this tax, saying that it'll drive businesses out of the city, and it's, you know, just putting your hands in the pockets of business again. And then the people who are for it say, we have to do this to clear the streets because the homeless crisis has been severe for many years.
So I see that the anticipated revenue, if it passes, is between $250, $300 million a year. Where would that money go?
Oh, it would. Half of it would go to housing, which has been the so-called best practice in approaching homelessness all over the country. And then a large proportion would go to mental health services because we have a real crisis of mentally ill homeless people wandering around with no place to go, and some for shelter beds, and then some to help prevent homelessness.
Now, in Los Angeles City and County, we've had a pair of measures, one to create housing, Measure Triple H in L.A. City, and then in the county, Measure H for services. But they've taxed essentially everybody. What was the reasoning in San Francisco to specifically go after the larger businesses for this money?
Well, the feeling was that they could afford it the best. They just got a huge tax break from the federal government. This tax would presumably be charging them less than they actually saved in the federal taxes. So times are pretty good economically in San Francisco, so the feeling was let's, you know, pitch in and do what we can from those who can afford it the best to help address the street crisis.
That high-profile controversy Kevin just mentioned includes Mark Benioff, who's the CEO of Salesforce, which is one of the big employers in San Francisco that would be affected. He's come out in favor of Measure C in San Francisco and taken on Jack Dorsey of Twitter, and who also runs Square, which is based in San Francisco. They've had some critical words going back and forth. Also with us from the Yes on C campaign, Executive Director of the San Francisco Advocacy Group Coalition on Homelessness, Jennifer Friedenbach. Thank you very much for being with us. What was the thought of advocates for this in taxing the larger employers in San Francisco as opposed to another way of raising the revenue?
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's just to clarify, it's not about the number of people that are employed. The way the tax works is on gross receipts. And so some companies have very high receipts with really low payroll, and others have, you know, a different kind of business model. And so, yeah, so the thinking was is that, you know, we wanted to put something together that that wasn't going to affect small business or medium-sized businesses. There was recently a measure on the ballot in June that there was a lot of criticism coming from the same folks who are opposing this measure that it would negatively impact small business. And like Kevin said, you know, we have this opportunity, you know, to try to recapture some of that federal revenue. Our current gross receipt structure in San Francisco is progressive, and so this adds another tier. Right now it's $25 million and above, and so adding another tier at $50 million and above can capture some of that revenue from businesses that are really solid and have massive amounts of income and frankly can afford it.
And in terms of the 4,000 individuals who would be housed, are there locations identified? I mean, San Francisco is very compact, as we all know, that are identified where you'd be able to create housing for the 4,000.
Yeah, so it's not 4,000 individuals, it's 4,000 housing units.
Units, okay, all right.
It would be families, it'd be about 6,000 people. And, yeah, everything's already identified, shovel-ready projects ready to go in the affordable housing pipeline that, you know, for example, we have a post office here in the downtown area that's going to be turned into homeless housing if there's funding 8 years from now. This would allow us to start working on that right away, create over 100 units of housing for homeless people. There's also units that are vacant that we can move people in right away that the landlords have contacted the city and told them that if they take over the management, residential hotels, that they would be able to offer up about 1,000 of those. And then there's some subsidies in the private market that we can utilize in the bottom 20% of the rental market. And so it's all laid out. We know exactly where the housing is going to go. It's just a matter of having the funds to do it.
We're talking with Jennifer Friedenbach of the Yes on C campaign in San Francisco. She's executive director of the Coalition on Homelessness there. Also with us is Jess Montejano, who is a spokesman for the No on C campaign and the former communications director for San Francisco's interim mayor, Mark Farrell. Thank you very much for being with us. Jess, what are your concerns about the effects of this if it were to pass?
Thanks for having me and happy to be here for the discussion. I think the diverse coalition with the No on C side that's supported by Mayor Breed and our state senator Scott Wiener and Assemblymember David Chu are very much concerned that this amounts to a blank check to one of our city's most pressing issues, with no real accountability reforms or new innovative approaches that are attached to this new spending whatsoever. We're concerned that since we've tripled our homelessness budget over the last decade, homelessness in San Francisco has still increased. And so what is very clear to the No on C side is that more money alone, again, with no accountability, is not a serious approach to our city's most pressing crisis.
Well, just because the homelessness numbers have gone up doesn't mean that the services have been ineffective. I mean, you mentioned triple budget. Are there additional units to show for that and additional hours of services to the homeless that have been created through that funding?
Yeah, if I could jump.
No, hold on just a moment. Yeah, Jess, go ahead.
Okay.
Jess, yeah, of course. You know, the city serves, I think, you know, the estimates show around 25,000, you know, homeless individuals potentially on an annual basis. And yes, the city of San Francisco spends more per capita on supportive housing than any other city in the country. But I think what's most concerning here, again, is that, you know, Jennifer likes to talk about shovel-ready projects. You know, these will take years upon years to bring online. You know, there's no guarantee that these 1,000 units she talks about will ever reach, you know, the city's hands. And I think what's the biggest empty promise about Prop C is that if it falls short of the 2/3, you know, usually necessary to secure the largest tax increase in San Francisco history, San Francisco may never see this money. And voters will be left holding the bag, expecting hundreds of millions of dollars to be spent on an issue that may never materialize.
Does this require 2/3 vote of San Franciscans?
No, it's
technically not
50%.
It's just, okay, 50 plus one. All right. We'll continue our conversation. That was Kevin Fagan of the San Francisco Chronicle, Jess Montejano of the No on C campaign, Jennifer Friedenbach of Yes on C. We'll continue. This tax that would be assessed against the largest companies in San Francisco based on gross receipts, averaging 0.5% of those gross revenues. We'll be back with more on Air Talk in 1 minute. Our ongoing election coverage on 89.3 KPCC will bring us Stephen Bailey in our next hour. He's the Republican candidate for California Attorney General. That's going to come up in our next hour right here on 89.3. The incumbent, Javier Becerra, will also be with us in the coming days. Right now, we talk about San Francisco's Measure C, which is a tax on gross receipts for the larger companies in San Francisco. Kevin Fagan, San Francisco Chronicle. How did this tax measure get on the ballot with just a simple majority?
Well, it can on with a simple majority, but there are fears that there will be legal challenges under Prop, you know, 13, the state law that says you need 2/3 for something like this. So the feeling is that if it passes, it'll get tangled up in some legal challenges. So the proponents are really shooting for 2/3 if they can get it.
All right. Jennifer Friedenbach, you wanted to come in and comment when Jess Montejano made the point that homelessness has become more of a problem as the city has spent more on addressing the problem.
Yeah, I mean, we've had a recession in the meantime. We've had a massive housing crisis up and down the West Coast. I know Los Angeles is deeply familiar with it. We've seen thousands of San Franciscans losing their home and becoming homeless. Look, we have a situation where currently our budget is housing 9,500 people. Under this measure, we know, you know, it lays out exactly where the money needs to go, which is what Kevin mentioned at the beginning. We know they keep mentioning the accountability issue because that's something that polls well, but it doesn't have any kind of semblance in reality. What we know is right now is that we are spending a lot of money on homelessness. We're spending money on homelessness by forcing people to stay homeless. We're spending tremendous amounts of money in ER costs when people can't get well and they return again and again to the hospital. We're spending a lot of money cleaning up our streets when we have 4,000 people who are living without sewage, without access to water. And so this situation means that, you know, if we don't invest and put people into housing, then we're not going to move the needle on this. We have, you know, we're going to continue having this situation where while we're able to house in our current system on turnover units about 50 people a week, we're going to continue having 100 people become homeless due to the real estate speculation that's happening. So we have to invest and get really ahead of this issue, or we're not going to move the dial. And it's a big, bold plan to do that.
What recourse does the public has? Let's say that this passes and the money that's raised isn't effectively being used, that you're not seeing the thousands of units constructed or rehabilitated for residency. You're not seeing the number of people who are getting the case contact with workers on a regular basis. So what recourse does the public have if it doesn't appear the money's being well spent?
Yeah, so the way that the measure works is that it goes into a specific fund. It has an oversight committee that that basically is, you know, it's required to have all the information be public and in terms of how the spending. And then it goes through the regular budgetary process where it goes through the departments and to the Board of Supervisors, and the mayor is able to approve or reject. There's plenty of public hearings in the budget process and ways for people to weigh in. But, you know, it builds on our current systems of accountability. Some of this money would go out to nonprofits. Other of it goes through the city systems. All of that has really intense levels of scrutiny.
All right.
Organizations have to get an independent audit. The city comes in and looks through the case files and sees whether they're meeting the contractual obligations. The funds are given out in a competitive manner. So,
all right. Jess Montano, I'm sorry to interrupt there, but I'm short on time. So your response to that about the degree of oversight with the funds if this passes?
It absolutely has oversight.
Oh, no. I'm asking Jess.
Yeah, thanks, Jennifer, for the time. I appreciate it. You know, our own mayor, London Breed, in her statement in opposition to C, says that there's no reforms or accountability that are attached to C, and that's what's most concerning to her. You know, the proponents have talked for months while pushing this measure forward that this is meant to lock in current funding levels. It's not meant to take away anything that we spend currently on our homelessness budget. So I think what's most concerning here is that it really takes away some of the budget flexibility that we need as a city. You know, obviously, we all agree that homelessness in San Francisco is a crisis. That's our number one issue. But we also have a lot of other pressing needs that we need to consider and budget for, including public safety, transportation, and things like that. And I think, again, the lack of flexibility that this measure seeks to lock in and, you know, provides is concerning. And our own mayor, who's charged with really implementing this new funding, if it is approved, is saying that herself. So I really trust her word.
Well, Jennifer's argument is, though, all this public money is being spent now to mitigate the effects of people being homeless, and that, you know, much of that cost could be avoided if the investment is made in housing and supportive services. Your response to that argument?
Look, Housing First is a national best model and known to reduce money over time and investments. So again, I think our side is for targeted investments to homelessness. We're not for a blank check that doubles our homelessness budget overnight with no reforms or accountability. There are a turn of proposals that were presented that were unfortunately rejected here. So again, it's not that there isn't a need for an investment. We just need smart investment.
Kevin Fagan of The Chronicle, how is this polling?
It's polling above 50% right now. Newer polls are coming out soon. But the public seems to be largely in support of it. I mean, historically, you propose taxing well-moneyed businesses, and, you know, your Joe worker isn't going to object too hard.
Unless they're people who work for those businesses and are right. Concerned it would have an effect on their paycheck. And I was also curious about the companies themselves that would be effective. Have they been lobbying their employees on this?
I don't know how hard they're lobbying their employees. I do know Mark Benioff he's very proactive, I guess, and progressive in the way he approaches these things. And he's certainly addressed homelessness here
quite a lot over the years, and his company is into it. Jack Dorsey over at Twitter and Square, he's firmly against it. I'd say the debate they've been having publicly hasn't been nasty. They've just been, you know, politely debating.
Pointed. Maybe that's the way to put it. I want to thank you. That's Kevin Fagan, San Francisco Chronicle, where he's covering homeless issues for the paper. And my thanks to Jennifer Friedenbach and Jess Montahano. It's Air Talk on KPCC.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a doctorate of education in organizational leadership, developing graduates with the knowledge and ability to transform organizations for optimal success and growth, offering an online hybrid format in West LA with attendance only twice per term, tailored for working professionals. Classes start January 7th. Apply by November 1st to be considered for a $3,000 scholarship opportunity at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC, and whether you're listening to the KPCC app, kpcc.org, or my favorite good old-fashioned radio, we're delighted to have you with us. And as Hetty just said, just want to reinforce it that we are on top of this story of the packages, some of which have been confirmed with explosive devices that have been sent to various addresses along the East Coast, including CNN's New York studios, the Clintons' home in area outside New York and others. We'll have the very latest details. President Trump is expected to speak at the White House rather soon. We will bring that to you right here on 89.3 KPCC. But first, a new report was just released by the Economic Policy Institute. The report concluding that just over 3 1/3 million jobs were lost in the United States to China. That's since 2001, when China entered the World Trade Organization. The report is titled "The China Toll Deepens," and it concludes that the state of California has lost more than 560,000 jobs during that same period of time. And that's about 3 1/3% of the total employment here in California. So a huge number that the Economic Policy Institute has concluded, with their senior economist at EPI and lead author of the report, Robert Scott. Sir, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
What was the analysis here? What numbers were you looking at to draw the conclusion about job loss?
We have a model that's based on changes in trade. The model assumes, like most economic models, that exports support domestic employment and imports cost jobs. And so I look at the jobs supported by exports in each of about 90 industries in the economy, and likewise the number of jobs lost due to growing imports in the same 90 industries. And actually the model then looks at the indirect effects overall in about 200 industries. We break up the economy into those smaller bits.
Looking at this regionally, which were the sectors that experienced the greatest loss here in California?
Absolutely. The number one was the computer and electronic parts sector that was, I think, responsible for about 56% of all jobs lost in California. So far and away, that was the hardest hit, much more than nationwide. That sector was responsible for about 1/3 of all jobs lost nationwide. So
just to clarify, those were electronic parts manufactured in California that are now manufactured in China?
Exactly. And computers. It's a broad category of computers. It includes everything from semiconductor chips to audio to telephones as well. It's a broad sector.
Is apparel, which Los Angeles was an apparel manufacturing center, and there still is a lot of apparel major, was that also an area with major loss?
Yes, that was particularly hard hit, especially in a couple of congressional districts in Los Angeles. I don't have the industry-specific data in front of me, but I think in the top 20, there were, I think, 8 or 9 districts from California. We looked at, as I said, by CD, and I think the 45th congressional district lost 4.5% of employment. I think the 34th lost 4.7%. I think I'm pretty sure the 45th was definitely concentrated in apparel.
So we're looking at central LA, southeastern LA county areas. And after the computer and electronic parts business, what was the next biggest loss for the state?
Well, it was certainly apparel.
It was apparel. Okay, that was number two. All right.
Yeah, that was number two. And then beyond that, I think the other hard-hit sectors in general, and these are the national figures, include the electrical machinery, such as appliances and those sorts of things, and other kinds of heavy so-called durable goods. One of the hardest hit sectors was actually what's called miscellaneous manufacturing, and that one of the biggest components of that is medical equipment, and that's, I think, another sector where you are probably a big employer in California.
Robert Scott with us, senior economist, lead author of the Economic Policy Institute's report, claiming that since China joined the World Trade Organization in 2001, that nearly 3.5 million U.S. manufacturing jobs have been lost, and then in California, more than 560,000 jobs were lost during the same period of time. With us is founding partner of Beacon Economics, based here in Southern California, Chris Thornburg. Chris, always good to have you with us. After looking at this analysis, what's your conclusion?
Well, Larry, you know, if you take a step back and you look at these numbers, from my perspective, the conclusions drawn in this report are at best problematic. And candidly, it largely misstates what I think the true impact of trade with China has been on the United States or California, as the case may be. There's so many different ways to start this conversation. I'm not even sure where to begin.
Well, can we start first with the methodology? So using the net trade numbers as a way of determining, does that make sense to you, first of all?
No, it doesn't, because we know that the trade deficit today is much larger than it was in 2000 and 2001. And the wideness of the trade deficit, it has to do with a lack of savings in the United States, particularly a lack of savings driven by our federal government, which is reaching all-time highs in terms of its budget deficit. That in turn, of course, causes us to really consume more from the rest of the world, which in turn winds the trade deficit and makes these numbers more dramatic. That's not anything to do with China. That's a problem with the federal government. Another big problem here is that there's this presumption that somehow or other an equivalent number of jobs would be created inside the United States. Realistically, if these parts were made here, they'd be made with far fewer workers, and the prices would be higher, and there'd be less consumption of it. And now I don't know the internal functioning of this model and how well it does a general equilibrium kind of analysis to account for these things. But I think the biggest problem all here, Larry, is let's take a step back and look at the California economy. The claim here is that somehow or other we have suffered because of China, when right now in California we see wages rising faster than most any place else inside the United States, and unemployment rates inside California are at a record low level at this particular moment in time. So regardless of the what you might want to call the reallocative impacts of trade with China, our economy is doing great. Workers are doing great. Households are doing great. And this, of course, would suggest the exact opposite, that somehow or other we are suffering as a result of these trade flows.
Chris Thornburg, Beacon Economics founding partner with us. Robert Scott, senior economist for EPI, which did the report. Is your response to Chris's skepticism about this?
I've heard these comments before. Frankly, I've been making predictions that China trade was going to lead to massive job loss since 2000, before we approved of their entry into the World Trade Organization. And I've just studied this. I've done, I think, 8 reports now which have looked at this ex post after the fact. And frankly, what's driving this trade deficit, which is causing these job losses, is not just some theoretical relationship between savings and investment, but in fact, it is unfair trade policies, most importantly, led by currency manipulation by China. Over a period of 15 years, China spent roughly $4 trillion buying up dollar assets that made its currency artificially cheap, acted like a subsidy to everything they exported to us, and a tax on everything that we would export, not just to China, but to the rest of the world. So, but for that subsidy, we would have had much more balanced trade. And if the trade were more balanced, it would generate and support more good jobs for American workers. And I think that's the key here to understanding how this is affecting the economy.
But Chris's argument was that if, for example, those electronic and computer parts were still manufactured in California, the prices would be higher, less of it would be sold, there'd be greater efficiency, so fewer total employees would be making the same number of parts, and there wouldn't be the advantage of less expensive parts that are coming from China. So does your model account for all those things?
It does. It's hard to come up with an exact counterfactual, which is what he's trying to come up with there. One of the problems of doing this kind of analysis is, in fact, the parts would cost more if they were made here. Well, that means that there would be more domestic content, including more workers involved in making these products. So we know we bought these products from China that were unfairly cheap due to their currency manipulation. Had they been fairly priced, we could have competed. And that would have generated more jobs here. But I think he, in an indirect way, supported my conclusion. Trade has changed the distribution of employment. So what we've got is many fewer good jobs in manufacturing, where most of these losses were, many more low-wage jobs in industries like home health care and retail trade. And that's what's happened in the economy in the last 20 years in the wake of the China trade deficit.
Chris, your response to the types of jobs created here?
Yeah, that's simply untrue. I mean, most of the manufacturing jobs in the United States have been lost to technological change. Economist after economist after economist has come up with that conclusion in an academic sense. Second thing is the idea that we have tons of bad jobs in the United States. Again, that's just not true. Unemployment rates are very low. Wages are rising at a solid basis once you control for the data appropriately. Retail jobs aren't up. Retail jobs are suffering because of the internet. Again, this goes back to the broader conversation, which is let's take a look around the U.S. today and ask ourselves, is our nation truly suffering? We have a 3.9% national unemployment rate. Unemployment in Los Angeles, in California, has never been lower, Larry. For all the complaints here, the reality is if you open your eyes and look around us, America has never been more prosperous or busier than it is today. It's really hard for me to take these numbers with any degree of seriousness. Now, this doesn't forgive China some of the things it has done. I mean, China does not play fair in the global trade sandbox. There are restrictions on investment. There are wholesale theft of American intellectual property rights. These are bad things. And yes, they do have an impact on us.
All right. I need to interrupt because President Trump is coming out at the White House, and Melania Trump is there with him as well. Large group of people in the room. It appears that this is another scheduled event by the president. Unclear what he is going to say about the explosive devices that have been sent to a number of addresses along the East Coast, including the CNN facility at Time Warner. All right. Melania Trump is speaking about the events of today.
Individuals and organizations. We cannot tolerate those cowardly attacks, and I strongly condemn all who choose violence. I'm grateful to the Secret Service, as well as the local and federal law enforcement, for all they do on a daily basis to keep us safe and encourage people across the country to choose kindness over hatred. I want to welcome you all to the White House to reflect on the progress this administration has made in tackling the opioid crisis, and more importantly, to look ahead at the work still to be done.
Melania Trump, First Lady, addressing an audience at an event that had been scheduled to talk about the opioid crisis and how the administration is attempting to deal with that. And we just heard her comments denouncing the mailing of and delivery of explosive devices to CNN's New York City newsroom and offices in the Time Warner Center. Also, we heard earlier today that a white powder of some kind was in an envelope that was included in that package with an explosive device that arrived at CNN. There was also a package with an apparent explosive device which was intercepted at a mail facility which handles mail that is addressed to Bill and Hillary Clinton's home in Chappaqua, New York. Also, reports of a package addressed to the Obamas' household. Again, these all intercepted away from the actual residences. There have been others as well. Yesterday morning at George Soros, the billionaire supporter of liberal causes and candidates, one of the members of his staff apparently received the package, actually brought it inside the gates from the mail drop. Fortunately, it did not detonate, but authorities were called after that appeared to be some sort of an explosive device as well. So that is where we stand. The FBI is conducting investigations at its laboratory to try and determine the composition of these packages, also what the intent is of the sender. Again, what appears to be in common they are either Democrats or, in CNN's case, a news organization that's openly critical of President Trump. That appears to be what's in common. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. My thanks to economist Chris Thornburg and Robert Scott. Coming up, we'll talk with Stephen Bailey, who is a former judge from Northern California. He's the Republican candidate for California Attorney General. Back in 1 minute on Air Talk. We're continuing to monitor the event at the White House dealing with opioids. First Lady Melania Trump is speaking about that right now. President Trump just giving his wife kisses on the cheeks. And we'll see if he approaches the microphone to speak. The president now getting, no, he's stepping to the lectern. Let's just hear what the president has to say in case he comments on these packages.
I want to thank you very much, Melania. I know how hard you've worked on this. And that's just one of many languages that you know. So it's just amazing the way you can do it. Thank you very much, darling. Appreciate it. Also, I want to thank Mrs. Pence for being here. You have been just so terrific working alongside of our great vice president. And thank you very much, Karen. Really appreciate it.
President Trump live at the White House.
I'd like to begin today's remarks by providing an update on the suspicious packages and devices mailed to current and former high-ranking government officials. The safety of the American people is my highest and absolute priority. I have just concluded a briefing with the FBI, Department of Justice, Department of Homeland Security, and the U.S. Secret Service. As we speak, the packages are being inspected by top explosive experts, and a major federal investigation is now underway. The full weight of our government is being deployed to conduct this investigation and bring those responsible for these despicable acts to justice. We will spare no resources or expense in this effort. And I just want to tell you that in these times, we have to unify. We have to come together and send one very clear, strong, unmistakable message that acts or threats of political violence of any kind have no place in the United States of America. Thank you.
Crowd in the room at the White House. Everybody standing following the remark by President Trump.
It's a very bipartisan statement. I can tell you from both sides, we both agree on that. This egregious conduct is abhorrent to everything we hold dear and sacred as Americans. My administration will provide additional updates as they become available. And I just want to thank everybody for their understanding. We're extremely angry, upset, unhappy about what we witnessed this morning, and we will get to the bottom of it. We're gathered together.
President Trump directly addressing the suspicious packages and actual verified explosive devices that arrived at CNN's New York City facility at Time Warner Center that was sent to the Clintons' home address, didn't get to the house, but was intercepted by a mail facility. Also, there have been reports of additional packages sent to members of Congress. Again, those are all received at a facility away from the congressional offices, and none of the packages, fortunately, have detonated. So that is the positive here, that we have not had any injuries, we've not had any detonations, and what's unclear, of course, is who is sending the packages, what the motive are. Again, at this point, they are all Democratic representatives or former representatives, or in the case of CNN, a network that has been highly critical in his treatment of President Trump. So as soon as we have additional information, we will bring it to you. The president saying we will spare no resources to get to the bottom of who is responsible for this. Joining us now is Stephen Bailey, Republican candidate for state attorney general. He's retired El Dorado County Superior Court judge. Mr. Bailey, thank you for your patience. I hope you understand we needed to hear what the president had to say.
When there's breaking news, you want to go to the breaking news.
And so right now you are the news. You're a candidacy against the incumbent, Javier Becerra, the Democrat. Let's talk first of all about what are the major areas where you would change the execution of the office of attorney general? Are you elected? What are the major changes you would bring?
Well, there's really three major areas that I'm going to be focusing on. One is public safety, and that is going after the gangs, the cartels, the human traffickers, the people that are possessing firearms that are statutorily prohibited from possessing those firearms. Take them away, because those are the ones going out and committing a large part of the gun violence in our state. You know, by the way, there's a list of 10,000 that the attorney general is solely responsible for going out and seizing those firearms. The second area is to take the partisanship out of the attorney general's office. The attorney general's office should be run in the least partisan manner of any office in California, because it's the law office of the people. It's not a special interest law firm. And my concern is the current incumbent has hyper-politicized the office of attorney general. And the third area is to rebuild our Department of Justice. It should be like the FBI for the state, and what it's become is a shell that's barely able to function.
And is that a funding issue, a priorities issue, both?
It is a priorities issue by the attorney general and the previous attorney generals. They put no stake in having a strong law enforcement presence in the state. And in fact, over the years, have cannibalized the Department of Justice for the benefit of the attorneys in the attorney general's office.
And explain what you mean by that.
Well, they haven't eliminated the crime labs in California. They've just effectively made the crime labs so overburdened that they're barely able to function in getting blood testing done, things needed by district attorneys throughout the state.
And where has that money gone instead?
Who knows where it has gone? It appears to have gone to hire more attorneys in the Attorney General's office. To give you some other examples of what has happened, the criminologists that used to be employed, the experts who did testing and testifying in court, we've now reached, unless you're doing DNA testing, we don't put any priority on having criminologists that are well-trained and skilled in the department, to the point of where criminologists in the department are forced to go get their own training on their own dime. And I think this is shameful, needs attention by the leader of the Department of Justice. And finally, we've got our special agents doing things like going out and investigating the fraud in the can and bottle business, as opposed to going out and chasing down drug traffickers, chasing down human traffickers. And as a result, the level of human trafficking and drug trafficking in the state has skyrocketed.
We're talking with Republican candidate for State Attorney General Stephen Bailey, the incumbent Democrat Javier Becerra, scheduled to join us tomorrow. Mr. Bailey, I wonder about the critique you made that the office has become too partisan. Are you speaking specifically about the lawsuits that the State Attorney General's office has filed against the Trump administration, or are there other examples beyond that?
Primarily the lawsuits, the 44, actually I think he's trying to intervene in a 45th lawsuit against the federal government. It seems like every time there's a tweet out of Washington, it results in a lawsuit. Now, that's a little bit, going overboard maybe, but the fact of the matter is the function of the office ought to be looking at protecting California and California interests. And in my opinion, what has happened is the Attorney General has conducted himself with the idea that these are going to propel him to his next office. And frankly, as a judge and a former trial attorney in California, I know that maybe the last place you want to be is litigating in court. It makes much more sense to sit down and try to negotiate issues that you have with your adversary. And if the federal government is, in fact, doing things that are not in California's interest, then the first thing you do is go sit down with them and see if you can't work the problem out. It's not unheard of that federal and state negotiations result in solutions. California has had mileage standards that exceeded the federal mileage standards for almost 50 years. And yet, when the federal government proposed changing mileage standards, what was the result in California? File a lawsuit, as opposed to sitting down with the federal government and seeing whether California couldn't work something out. And as your new attorney general, my focus is going to be let's negotiate, talk, and solve problems as opposed to running through the courthouse door as the first and only result.
Stephen Bailey, Republican candidate for California Attorney General. My guess would be that tomorrow Javier Becerra is going to argue that the Trump administration isn't interested in talking with California, that it would see no benefit in that, and that the administration is serving its supporters, not the interests of Californians who see the world very differently. So what's your response to that argument that it really takes a lawsuit, an effort to legally put a block in place that the conversations wouldn't produce anything that would help California?
Well, I think this is symptomatic of the fact that the appointed incumbent has been a politician in Washington for the last 26 years. Almost nothing is getting done, whether you're a Republican or Democrat in Washington. And what we need is a fresh voice, a fresh face who can go, who doesn't go to Washington with the idea that we're going to fight with them every single time. I'm a firm believer that the federal government, whether it's controlled by Republicans or Democrats, doesn't do everything right. But as a judge, I know that litigation usually results in everybody being unhappy. And the way to get the job done is to sit down and negotiate.
All right. Let me break. We'll continue our conversation with Republican candidate for California Attorney General Stephen Bailey. He was an El Dorado County Superior Court judge. Tomorrow, the incumbent Democrat Javier Becerra will be with us. We'll be back with more conversation right after a live update from Hedy Lynn Herdes. If you have questions for our guest, Republican candidate for State Attorney General Stephen Bailey, you can put them on the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. You can also call and share them with one of our screeners at 866-893-KPECC. We have monkey rights on the page. Judge, please tell me your interest in reducing wrongful convictions and punishment for corrupt judges and prosecutors. Stephen Bailey, I want to respond to Monkey's question.
Sure. You know, there is an abundance of things that need to be investigated within California government. If someone has in fact violated a law, there needs to be a prosecution of that. We need to, however, continue to balance prosecution with due process. And, you know, what makes me unique as a candidate for attorney general is not only did I spend 8.5 years as a judge, but I also spent 18.5 years representing indigent defendants here in California. So I've got a balance between the due process rights of our citizens and the right of our citizens to be safe and protected.
I also wanted to ask you, another listener brings up the issue of state ballot initiatives, the ballot propositions. The state attorney general's office plays a role in certifying the title for it before it goes out and gets circulated. And do you take issue at all with the title and summary, the way the attorney general's office has signed off on the process for initiatives?
I do take issue with that. And that relates to the hyper-partisanship of the attorney general's office in recent times. Ballot titles and summaries should be written in a fair and objective manner. We shouldn't have a situation where we have ballot titles being focus grouped or survey defined. They ought to be written so that the average voter doesn't have to figure out what the initiative in fact does. If it's a tax increase repeal, it ought to say it's a tax increase repeal. It ought to be honest and objective, and that's what the people of California expect from their attorney general. We're simply not getting that right now.
The current Attorney General Javier Becerra, he has been very clear about taking on President Trump. You mentioned the 40-some legal filings, cases that have been filed against the Trump administration. One of our listeners, BB Steve, wants to know what your view is of President Trump. His view is, BB Steve's is, that that the president is in opposition to California and that it's important for the attorney general to fight back against that. So what is your view of President Trump and his administration?
Well, I think that President Trump's handling of the economy has been excellent. I think his handling predominantly in foreign affairs has been excellent. I don't agree with him on everything. I wish he would tweet less. But I don't think there's general hostility towards California. I think when we pretend that there is, that actually hurts California. And that's why, as your new attorney general, I'm going to sit down and talk to them first. It's not that I don't believe that there's a time for litigation, but our current attorney general, it's litigation first, talk after we've been beaten by the federal government. And I think it ought to be opposite. I think we ought to sit down, negotiate these issues out first. I think there's common ground between California and the federal government on many, many issues. I think having a leader as attorney general would help facilitate solutions in Washington. And frankly, I don't think we're getting any leadership out of the current incumbent.
On the issue of California's sanctuary state bill that was passed, which limits the degree of law enforcement assistance that can be provided ICE authorities, what role would your office take if you were elected in dealing with the implementation of that law or fighting against it?
Well, I think the law itself is seriously flawed. Number one, it's not providing sanctuary to anyone but to convicted criminals. And that doesn't benefit legal, illegal immigrants to this country or the citizens of this country. I think ultimately it's going to be stricken as unconstitutional. And I would like to see California be cooperative with the federal government in many aspects. And take leadership in Washington to solve the issue of immigration. And quite frankly, I don't think Republicans or Democrats in Washington are focused on solving problems, and particularly not solving the problem of immigration reform.
Mr. Bailey, I want to thank you for being with us and talking about your candidacy. We appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Republican Steve Bailey, he is a former El Dorado County Superior Court judge. Stephen Bailey, Republican. Tomorrow, the Democratic incumbent, Javier Becerra, with us for the same amount of time. We'll talk with him as well. Coming up on Air Talk, a new report that's come out of the UK, a governmental report which attempts to quantify the amount of time that women spend on what they label safety work, what we've typically called precautions to keep women safe. So how much time do you spend, if you're a woman, dealing with your own personal security? Do you even think about it? Or are there things that you've just grown up doing that you've incorporated? It's almost without conscious thought. It's so much a part of your daily life. We're at 866-893-KPCC. Back in 1 minute on Air Talk. The deputy news editor of Quartz, Jackie Bischoff, just wrote a piece about what is termed safety work in a recently released UK government report. Jackie's article, you know, talks about all the unpaid work that women do and attempting to quantify that. It says you can add what the UK calls safety work to the list. These are the kinds of precautions that women take on a regular basis, investing time in to try and keep themselves safe, that in many cases they're not even consciously aware of. Jackie, thank you for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me, Larry.
So, how did the UK report quantify this? Were they able to come up with like an average amount of time that women spend on doing this kind of prep?
Well, it's a really interesting question because I think that a lot of women, for the most part, don't even realize that they're doing it. A lot of these preemptive measures are subconscious. they're something that women have been socialized to do, and it's so it may be something they're just doing as a part of their routine, as a part of their daily experience, and it's really difficult to quantify, but there was some anecdotal evidence that was pulled out in this report and discussed.
And what are some of the examples of these sorts of efforts that women make to take extra safety precautions?
Well, Larry, the list is very long, and it's very interesting to read some women talk about these things, because I think that it could be quite surprising to men to know how the efforts that women take to do these things. But it could be something like changing your route at night to avoid certain areas, making sure that you're watching your drink being poured at a bar, trying to think very carefully about the way that you dress in particular situations. And it could be even as serious for some women as moving jobs or moving cities to avoid sexual harassment. Again, these are preemptive, proactive measures that women are taking to protect themselves.
Norman Lakewood writes on the AirTalk page, it'd be interesting to know. We have is President Trump speaking right now? Excuse me. President Trump at the White House expected to address more questions about the suspicious packages. Apparently not. What? I'd love to hear from you. Apparently he wrapped up. So the president did not have additional information on that. Our phone lines are open. I'd like to hear from you as a listener to Air Talk. What are some of the ways that maybe you don't even think about it a lot, you take extra safety precautions if you're a woman? How much time is involved in that? Or what are the ways do you limit your life as a result of safety concerns? We're at 866-893-KPCC. That's 866-893-5722. Norman Lakewood, as I mentioned, writing on our Air Talk page, said it'd be interesting to know if men look in the back seats of their cars before they get in or consciously walk confidently down a street. That's a good question, Norma. One of the things I brought up in our morning staff meeting, our editorial meeting, was when I'm out walking my dog at night, if it's after dark and I see a woman who's out walking by herself or walking her dog, and we're on the same side of the street, I will walk into the street to give her a clear sign that there's no potential threat. I'm a man by myself, but just as a gesture of sort of, you know, of safety concern. And it's so funny because what is the typical response is the woman will look over and smile and nod. There's some sort of gesture, say good evening or something like that. So in some cases, there are things that we as men do, obviously nowhere near as common or to the degree that women will do to try and deal with a potential safety concern or abusive behavior. I'd like to hear from you. What are the ways in which you limit yourself or that you invest time? You know, maybe it's taking pepper spray with you or whatever it is. 866-893-KPCC or the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. From Quartz, Deputy News Editor Jackie Bischoff is with us to talk about this. Jackie, I was struck by the range of this. For some women, they might be just, you know, very minor, a few simple things. But you used the example of, you know, cases where a woman will actually leave town because she doesn't feel safe staying. So for some women, this totally upends their lives.
Yes, it can be really, really devastating for some women to have to deal with these incidences. But I do think equally problematic is how insidious this behavior is. And at least that women are expected to participate in it and take responsibility for their personal safety. And I think a lot of women right now are pushing back on that narrative and saying that perhaps we should instead be talking about the ways in which women shouldn't be hurt as opposed to the ways in which women should be protecting themselves from being hurt.
So what would that mean if the emphasis shifted?
I think that in particular, not saying that women should make more efforts to protect their safety or when things happen in which, for example, the recent case that I mentioned in my story was the murder of a young woman in Melbourne, where the police, after the murder, issued a warning saying that people should take more responsibility for their safety. And that woman had actually, in fact, taken several measures to protect herself. And, you know, immediately after that, it's not helpful to say that women should be doing more when really what the issue is that she was in a violent situation and she was hurt despite taking those measures. So I think that's the way that women want this conversation to start changing a little bit.
Let's talk with Nicole in Santa Monica. You're on Air Talk. What sorts of precautions do you take?
Thank you, Larry. I do not take the trash out at night. I do not do the laundry at night. I do not go out at night. I mean, I don't do things unless I absolutely have to when it's dark out. And then in daylight, I'm just extremely aware. Before I get out of my car, I look around all the time. It's very limiting.
Do you feel as though your concern matches the degree of risk for yourself, or do you feel at all like you're overly cautious?
Honestly, my way of approaching this is it only takes one time. So I probably am very cautious, but I don't think it's overly cautious.
Yeah, so even though these events are rare, the stakes are so high.
Exactly.
If something happens.
Unless I know who's on the other side of it, because it only takes once.
Nicole, I appreciate it. Thank you for sharing your experience. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Elena in Sherman Oaks, you're on Air Talk. To what degree do you take precautions for personal safety?
I feel like every moment of my day, there's an awareness. And I know that since losing a lot of weight, I have completely changed my awareness and the way I interact with people. It's changing who I am, quite frankly. And I've found that I don't smile at men as much. I don't make eye contact as much. I used to be far more friendly, but the attention that I get when I do that, when I'm innocently friendly, is very uncomfortable. And I work with a lot of women who actually keep weight on and are living unhealthy lives because they are fearful for their safety, and it's easier to keep men and predators at bay by being unattractive, overweight, and really unappealing to the opposite sex and to potential predators just because they're uncomfortable and they fear for their safety.
So you feel like there's a difference in sort of the average perception of attractiveness and risk involved? I mean, is that – I understand you saying you get more attention from men. Do you think that that really equates to a higher risk based on appearance?
Absolutely.
Really? Jackie Bischoff, you want to respond to that?
I would like to say to both this caller and Nicole's point, I think that it's incredibly difficult to evaluate levels of risk. There's only risk and no risk. And for women, I think the important point here is that it puts women in an incredibly difficult bind, almost a catch-22, because whatever reason you think that you're attracting the risk, whether it's because you're, you know, pretty or charismatic or you're wearing a certain types of clothes or whatever the point is that you're thinking it and you're feeling it and you're fearing it, and it's absolutely exhausting. And that's why we refer to it as kind of an unhidden work in that women try to prevent it from happening because they fear it, even if the chance of it happening is unclear. It's a constant state of anxiety.
Let's talk with Brooke in Van Nuys. Brooke, I'm really short on time, but real quickly, I know you've lived in a number of different cities. So how do you deal with this when you're out at night?
Either walking in the middle of the street, if it's late enough to where there's not a lot of traffic, making eye contact if a man crosses my path, making sure that they see that I see them, and keeping distance. And again, like, possible staying off the sidewalk. My aunt growing up told me that. She's been mugged in New York, and staying like in the street as opposed to the sidewalk helps for like prevent the element.
All right. Brooke, I appreciate your call. Thank you. Bridget in Azusa says, I never leave my drink alone. I carry pepper spray if I'm traveling on Lyft. I don't even drink because I have to be coherent. I don't think about these things, Bridget says. It's just built in, and I'm already teaching my 13-year-old daughter to do this as well. I want to thank you for your calls, and my thanks to Quartz Deputy News Editor Jackie Bischoff for sharing this report from the UK government. Thanks so much from all of us on Air Talk. Have a great afternoon. Fresh Air with Terry Gross is next.